This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everyone. My name is Henry Leuenberger, and we are back with Reader's Digest, March and April edition. And we are going to continue our cover story with Snow's Dance with Death, Neighbors Save a Cold Snake and Solve a Cold Case by Kathy Free from the Washington Post. Patrick Fortune was walking his dog in his Austin, Texas neighborhood in December 2022 when he spotted something long and yellow down a ravine 30 feet below. He remembered that someone had posted on Nextdoor months back that a 16-foot albino python, Snow, had been taken from her owner's vehicle in her travel tote. Could this be the missing snake? Quote, "She's a big, gentle giant," the poster, Daryl Fields, wrote. "I'm sure whoever broke in my vehicle freaked out realizing it was a snake inside. Please give me a call if you hear or see anything," end quote. When Fortune, 34, realized on that December day that he had found the missing python, he took his dog home and told his girlfriend, Raven Zimmer, 33. He wasn't sure if the snake was alive or dead, he says, but if she was alive, they should rescue her. Zimmer was on board. Quote, "I knew that pythons were tropical. They like to be warm," end quote, Fortune says, noting that it had been cold in Austin for weeks and that it was chilly 45 degrees when he spotted Snow. Fortune and Zimmer warmed up a heating pad, grabbed a few towels, and loaded their large dog crate onto their truck. A neighbor called animal control, but the person he spoke with said it would take a couple of hours to get an officer to the area. Fortune figured that if the snake was still alive, they didn't have the luxury of time. Quote, "The snake looked dead to us, but Raven reached out and touched it, and we were surprised when it moved," he says. "I thought, oh, that's different. Now what do we do?" End quote. He texted people he knew in the neighborhood, hoping someone would help. When Dylan Doherty, 29, got word, he rushed over from his parents' house across the street from the ravine. Quote, "I like the strange and unusual, so I was all in," end quote, Doherty says. The trio decided that Fortune would firmly hold the snake behind the head while Zimmer and Doherty picked up her body and scooted it into the carrier. Quote, "The snake didn't seem to like that," Fortune says. "It reared up and opened its mouth, and it gave me a don't mess with me look," end quote. Although Snow was 75 pounds, 10 inches around and hissing, they weren't afraid of getting bitten or constricted because the snake was moving slowly in the cold. Quote, "We were genuinely worried about the snake. It could freeze to death in the cold," Fortune says. "We tried picking her up again, and she became lethargic and didn't fight us this time," end quote. Quote, "She was ice cold. It was like picking up a cold, slimy rock," end quote, Doherty adds. He and Zimmer tucked the heating pad and blanket around the snake in the carrier. Then all three of them pushed the heavy crate up the embankment. They took the python to Doherty's house because he lived the closest. Quote, "We took the snake inside, and I got some wood, and Patrick started the fire," Doherty says. "I also started up a space heater," end quote. He had an infrared digital thermometer, which he held to the snake's head every few minutes. Quote, "The first time, it read 53 degrees, he says. Raven was Googling for information about pythons and learned the temperature was supposed to be in the 70s, so we were relieved when it started going up," end quote. About 90 minutes into their herpetology urgent care experiment, the doorbell rang. An animal control officer was there to pick up the snake. When the officer walked into the living room holding a small cat carrier, everyone burst into laughter. Quote, "The officer took one look and said, oh, that's a big snake," end quote, Fortune says. Snow had probably survived for nearly 6 months in the ravine by eating mice and rabbits and the occasional possum, the officer said. She was transported to the Austin Zoo while other animal control officers tracked down Snow's owner. Fields drove to Austin a few days later to pick up his pet, posting on Facebook that he was, quote, "so glad to have my baby back," end quote. Fortune says he hopes Snow is warm and happy now that she's home. Quote, "I'm not a snake person," he adds, "but I'm really glad she made it," end quote. Next, we're going to be continuing the cover story with Tucker's cross-country crisis. A Good Samaritan realizes this cat is far from astray and far from home, by Bill Hangley Jr. Holly Lillard went outside just to wash the windows. She didn't go out that day to help save a pet or a person, but that's what happened when she found a lost cat named Tucker and closed a 600-mile gap to return him to his owner, Jamie McCall. Tucker's adventure began in early November 2022 when McCall, 64, spent the night in a hotel in the tiny town of Cleveland, Tennessee. The retired electrician was driving from Florida to Michigan to visit a sick relative. Her budget was tight, and her head was full of questions. In the previous 2 years, McCall had lost her husband to cancer and their 21-year-old grandson to violence, and a workplace accident had left McCall partially disabled and unable to work. Quote, "I'm still looking for a place in the world," says McCall. "I was married for almost 43 years. I'm not sure where I'm supposed to be," end quote. But even as everything changed around her, the future held one certainty. She'd have her two cats, Tucker and the 20-pounder she calls Fat Cat. The companionship and the routine of having to care for the animals were a lifeline when all else was upended. Quote, "Honestly, after all the deaths, I was ready to give up," says McCall. "If it hadn't been for those two cats, I don't think I would have made it," end quote. McCall planned to spend the night in Cleveland and drive on, but Tucker had other ideas. When McCall returned from breakfast the next morning, ready to pack up and hit the road again, the big black and white cat was gone from her hotel room. Frantic, she searched along the busy road for hours, hoping Tucker hadn't been hit by a car, but he was nowhere to be found. As dusk fell, Miss McCall realized she had to go. She couldn't afford to stay another night. Heartbroken, she got in her car and got back on the interstate. Quote, "I'd just been through all this tragedy, and now I'd lost Tucker," she recalls. "We drove off with Fat Cat crying all the way, going, 'Where's my brother? I thought he was gone forever,'" end quote. Little did McCall know, the good people of Cleveland were about to come through. The next day, Lillard, 27, went to wash the back windows of her CBD dispensary shop, just down the road from the hotel where McCall had stayed. The moment she spotted Tucker by the dumpster, she knew he wasn't one of the usual strays. He trotted straight to her and looked well-fed. Quote, "He was clearly not a stray cat," says Lillard. "He's a big lug," end quote. Lillard took Tucker home, certain he was someone's missing friend, and posted his story in a Lost Pet Facebook group. McCall, too, had been posting about Tucker. Within hours, someone made the connection, and soon McCall was on the phone with Lillard, hearing Tucker's yowls and sobbing with relief. Quote, "It was his voice. He's very vocal," says McCall. "I knew right away. That's my cat," end quote. McCall's luck was changing. Lillard's grandfather was planning a trip to Michigan, and Lillard was happy to shelter Tucker until the cat could hitch a ride with him. 1 month later, Tucker was hand-delivered to McCall's doorstep, just in time for Christmas. Today, Tucker, Fat Cat, and McCall are back in Florida together. McCall still isn't sure what her future holds, but she knows it will include her old friends, Tucker and Fat Cat, and her new friend, Lillard. Quote, "They brought my cat right to my front door, and they didn't ask for a dime. Can you believe that? I don't have to say another word," end quote, says McCall. Next, we have Operation Find Avery. Veteran uses Marine tactics to rescue a stolen Yorkie. This is by Justin Juvenal and Dana Hedgepeth from the Washington Post. Raquel Witherspoon, 38, was frantically searching for her daughter's Yorkshire Terrier, Avery, in June 2022 after making a shocking discovery. Doorbell camera footage showed a young woman with dyed red hair creep onto her front porch, throw treats to Avery, then make off with a tiny dog. Witherspoon's case of a missing pet turned into something sinister when, 24 hours after the dog napping, her cell phone buzzed. In menacing texts laced with profanity and misspellings, someone claimed to have Avery and sent a video of the pup in a cage. The conversation was punctuated with a threat to kill the dog and a demand for ransom. Quote, "Y'all not getting y'all dog back, y'all paying $1,200, no funnies," end quote. Quote, "I'm going to get your dog back," end quote, Witherspoon kept telling her 12-year-old daughter, Samaj, with more hope than belief. Witherspoon pleaded with the dog napper, texting that her daughter relied on Avery for emotional support, but the napper texted back, quote, "Ha ha," end quote. In a flurry of messages and calls, the negotiations soon collapsed. The dog napper went silent. Avery had gone missing the night before, a Saturday, and Witherspoon had quickly filed a police report. On Monday, she stood in front of a local news camera and told a reporter the dog, quote-unquote, "means the world," to her family as photos of the fluffy pooch flashed across the screen. Quote, "I want Avery back," end quote, she pleaded as Samaj stood next to her in their front yard. Rick Mockimer saw the broadcast. Quote, "I have two dogs of my own," he says. "I couldn't fathom my reaction if someone took one, especially if they sent a picture of one in a cage," end quote. Mockimer had served as a Marine in the Iraq War. He now runs a corporate intelligence company. He contacted Witherspoon and offered his help. She quickly agreed and sent Mockimer the doorbell video, the dognapper's phone number, and other evidence. He ran the dognapper's phone number through a database, but it was unregistered. He used software to try to extract geolocation data from the video of Avery in the cage, but none existed. He even waded through customer service reviews of local salons in Witherspoon's area, hoping to find the perpetrator since she had distinctive dyed hair. He struck out again. Then Mockimer tried one last trick. He put the dognapper's phone number in his iPhone contacts, which were linked to his Instagram account. He knew that Instagram would likely recommend he follow any accounts associated with that number. Soon enough, Instagram did just that, offering up a profile, a body-piercing business near Witherspoon's Maryland home. Mockimer found the business owner's personal Instagram account and saw that she had posted about another dog that had gone missing before Avery. Another post featured a photo of police talking to a family about that dog, including someone who looked like the dog napper in Witherspoon's doorbell camera footage. The photo also showed the address of the home. Mockimer felt a rush of excitement. He wasn't totally sure, but he thought he may have identified the dog napper. He texted Witherspoon, who'd been doing her own sleuthing, and noticed that the quote-unquote missing dogs flyers she'd posted near the address identified by Mockimer had been torn down. She took all of the information to the police. After two agonizing days of waiting, a detective called and said, quote, "I have Avery. I'm on my way," end quote. Police said Avery had been recovered in the home Mockimer had identified from the photo, and they charged a 16-year-old girl with stealing the dog. Samaj was sitting on a couch when a police officer walked in with Avery. Samaj ran to the dog and hugged him. Avery bounded around the house and the pair went outside to play. Quote, "I was like, they got him back," says Samaj. "I didn't want to face the reality of not seeing my dog again," end quote. Thankfully, she didn't have to. All right, next we have inspiration, words to live by. Poems offered me an anchor as I lost my son, so I shared them. This is by Josie Glauzowitz from the Washington Post. In the early hours of March 23rd, 2023, about 12 hours before our treasured 12-year-old son died from a rare form of brain cancer, I climbed into his bed at Shaar Zedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, wrapped him in my arms and recited the poem, quote-unquote, Jabberwocky. Quote, "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toads did gyre and gimble in the wabe," end quote. My child was no longer conscious, but I hoped and believed that he could sense my presence, and that my voice would comfort him and soothe his furiously beating heart. My son had learned the words to Lewis Carroll's nonsense poem by listening to me recite it to him and his twin sister at bedtime. A brave, bright, imaginative, optimistic boy, he loved the drama of the poem and the courage of the quote-unquote beamish boy as, with his quote-unquote vorpal sword, end quote, in hand, he defeats his quote-unquote manxome foe. My son was also a passionate reader, but toward the end of the year, punctured by surgeries, rounds of radiation, hospitalizations, and medications, it was harder for him to focus. Instead, I would sit beside his hospital bed and read aloud to him, mostly Richmond Crompton's Just William stories. One evening in the hospital in mid-February, I read him some of my favorite poems, poems that my mother had read to me as a child. Cargoes by John Masefield, quote, "Quinquirmi of Nineveh from distant Ophir, rowing home to haven in sunny Palestine," end quote, and a Shakespeare sonnet, quote, "When in disgrace with fortune in men's eyes," end quote. He listened, rapt and smiling. Then we talked about the meaning of the poems. A few days later, I started my own poetry group on WhatsApp, calling it Poetry is Medicine, and invited friends to join. I had found, during earlier crises, that the rhythm of poetry can soothe my anxieties. With just a word or a phrase, a poem can reach the hidden places that prayers or well-meaning advice cannot. The poems offered an anchor to me during unpredictable and painful times. In a calm interlude each day, I searched in my anthologies and on sites such as Poetry Daily for the quote-unquote right poem to share. The quote-unquote right poem could be about almost anything. An apple tree, an insect, a pie, a miracle. Some are classics. Everyone Sang by Siegfried Sassoon. Amas Love by Sir Edward Dwyer. Quote, "The lowest trees have tops, the ant her gall," end quote. One, a psalm. Quote, "The Lord to me a shepherd is, want therefore shall not I," unquote. People responded with heart emojis and their own favorites. My mother shared Shakespeare's soliloquies. Quote, we had to learn chunks by heart, end quote, she wrote. My sister and I exchanged messages about the poems of R.S. Thomas, which we had studied in school, recalling one that begins, quote, all right, I was Welsh, what does it matter, end quote. Friends contributed. One sent, quote, one sent Chinese foot chart by K. Ryan, quote, look, boats of mercy, embark from our heart at the oddest knock, end quote. Another friend carefully translated the Hebrew poem, Apple of Imperfection, by Varda Ginesor.
I'm ready.
Quote, first speech is the speech of love. Last speech,
hello,
silence.
This is Terry Malloy, here to read the third hour of
the poems
of
took
Cincinnati.
On a life of their own. Friends shared them with their friends, saying that the verses added joy to their day. Quote, the poems that you sent express in words feelings I have no ability to express, end quote, my friend Marilyn wrote. One old school friend bought new collections, telling me, quote, it's been years, actually decades, since I've read poetry, but you have rekindled an interest, end quote. At 9:22 a.m. on March 23rd, 2023, I shared the poem Jabberwocky with my WhatsApp group. My son's heart stopped beating 3.5 hours later as I held his hand and sang to him. For our family, my husband, our daughter, his loss is a catastrophe. The space that our son had filled with his loving nature, his exuberance, his magical smile, his luminous observations, and his laughter was replaced by a gigantic empty hole. I stopped posting poems. Then my friend Layla sent me Late Fragment, Raymond Carver's last published poem. Quote, and what did you want? To call myself beloved? To feel myself beloved on the earth? End quote. It offered me some small comfort, because I knew that even in my son's darkest hours, he was always loved, and still is. It was never for a moment alone. I shared Late Fragment with my poetry group, and I began, again, to share poems and songs. One was Taking Care by Calista Bushin. Quote, I sit with my grief. I mother it. I hold its small, hot hand. I don't say shh, end quote. Another was Theme in Yellow. The title contains my son's favorite cheerful color, by Carl Sandburg. Quote, when dusk is fallen, children join hands and circle round me, singing ghost songs, end quote. Friends posted yellow heart emojis. They added comments, quoted favorite lines. I felt loved and supported, and I was able to get up in the morning and take care of my daughter, who has lost her twin and only sibling, from whom she had never been apart. 7 weeks before my son died, we had celebrated our daughter's bat mitzvah. In synagogue, she read beautifully from the Torah portion of Beth Shalach, in which the Israelites, fleeing slavery in Egypt, crossed the Red Sea on dry land, as, quote, the waters formed a wall for them on their right hand and on their left, end quote. Itself a beautiful poem, it reflected my feelings, that our community had formed strong walls around us, supporting us at every step of our grueling journey. Perhaps that's why the poem that is most meaningful to me is Moises, or Moses, by Luis Alberto de Cuenca, translated from Spanish by Gustavo Perez Fermat. On the eighth day after my son died, I read it aloud beside his grave. Give me your hand. We have to cross the river and my strength fails me. Hold me as if I were an abandoned package in a wicker basket, a lump that moves and cries in the twilight. Cross the river with me. Even if this time the waters don't part before us, even if this time God doesn't come to our aid and a flurry of arrows riddles our backs, even if there is no river. All right, we're going to get into national interests. What happens to all the stuff we return? Think your rejects go back on the shelves? Think again. This is by David Owen from The New Yorker. The 20-something daughter of a friend recently ordered half a dozen new dresses. She'd been invited to the wedding of a college classmate and knew in advance that she was going to send back all but the one she liked best. Quote, swimsuits and dresses for weddings, you never buy just one, end quote, says Joni Demmer, co-founder of Crazy Coupon Lady. For some online apparel retailers, returns now average 40% of sales. Steady growth in internet shopping has been accompanied by steady growth in returns. A forest's worth of artificial Christmas trees goes back every January. Bags of green plastic Easter grass go back every spring. returns of large screen TVs surge immediately following the Super Bowl. People who buy portable generators during weather emergencies use them until their emergencies have ended, and then those go back too. People who've been invited to fancy parties sometimes buy expensive outfits or accessories, then return them the next day, caviar stains and all, a practice known as wardrobing. Brick-and-mortar stores also allow shoppers to return unwanted purchases. Quote, Petco takes back dead fish, end quote, Demmer said. Quote, Home Depot and Lowe's let you return dead plants for a year. You just have to be shameless enough to stand in line with the thing you killed, end quote. Last year, I attended a three-day conference in Las Vegas conducted by the Reverse Logistics Association, a trade group whose members deal with product returns, unsold inventories, and other capitalist jet sam. The field is large and growing. Dale Rogers, a business professor at Arizona State, gave a presentation with his son, Zachary Rogers, a business professor at Colorado State, during which they said that winter holiday returns in the United States are now worth more than $300 billion a year. Quote, so 1.5% of U.S. GDP, which would be bigger than the GDP of many countries around the world, is just the stuff that people get for Christmas and said, nah, do they have blue? End quote, Zachary said. The annual retail value of returned goods in the U.S. is said to be approaching $1 trillion. Most online shoppers assume that items they return go back into regular inventory to be sold again at full price. That rarely happens. At the conference, I joined a round table led by Nikos Papayonau, who manages returns of Amazon's house brand electronic devices, including Kindles, Echoes, and Blink home security systems. I asked what proportion of return products are resold as new. Quote, it's minimal, he said. If the seal has been broken, if the wrap is not intact, then it's not going back to the shelf, end quote. How we got here? For a long time, a shocking percentage of online returns were simply junked. The industry term is DIF, for quote-unquote, destroy and field. This still happens with cheap clothes, defective gadgets, and luxury items, but in most product categories, it's less common than it used to be. People often assume that easy refunds and exchanges began with the online shoe store Zappos, which was founded in 1999. Tony Tsai, the company's legendary late CEO, offered free returns for up to a year after purchase and encouraged people to order items in multiple styles and sizes. That policy, backed by intensely personal customer service, was so popular that the company's revenues grew more than sixfold in 4 years. In fact, America's true refund pioneer was born a century before Tsai on a farm in Oklahoma. In 1902, he moved to Kemmerer, Wyoming, in order to become a one-third owner of a general store called Golden Rule. Within a few years, he had bought out his partners and opened more stores, and in 1913, he consolidated his holdings under his own name, JCPenney. The initials stand for James Cash. One of his innovations was allowing customers to return anything, no questions asked. That approach made a permanent impression on Sam Walton, who went to work at a Penney store in Des Moines in 1940. 22 years later, Walton founded his own chain, Walmart, and adopted a similarly generous return policy, which is still in effect. Homer Simpson, quote, the customer's always right. That's what everybody likes about us, end quote. A century ago, the average return rate at Penny's was probably something like 2%. Before internet shopping truly took hold, retail returns had risen to more like 8% or 10%. Returns to online retailers now average close to 20%, and returns of apparel are often double that. Among the many reasons, products often look nothing like their online images, such as a crocheted bikini top that was barely big enough for the purchaser's cat, and colors and fabrics appear different on different screens. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated growth in online shopping, and therefore in returns, by several years. Quarantine lawyers bought fewer neckties but more sweatpants and bedroom slippers. People who were suddenly forced to work from home ordered desks, chairs, and computers. Pre-pandemic, a common shopping strategy was to study possible purchases in a regular store, then save a few dollars by ordering from Amazon. When in-person shopping became difficult, the best way to compare products was to order multiples and send back the rejects. Retailers try to keep up. Returns are expensive for sellers, since shipping alone often costs more than the items can be resold for. Many retailers have responded by shrinking their refund windows or by imposing fees for postage or so-called restocking. Some sellers offer store credit only. Amazon now adds a quote-unquote frequently returned item label to some listings and encourages potential purchasers to double-check descriptions and customer reviews before ordering. The online business model of the eyeglasses seller, Warby Parker, is based on easy returns. Customers can order as many as 5 frames, at no risk, to try on at home. The company still offers that option but has reduced its return costs by employing an increasingly sophisticated online tool that allows customers to try on glasses virtually. It also has physical stores, which have mirrors. Despite the cost, retailers worry that discouraging returns discourages buying in the first place. Easy returns are like free shipping. They can be a deal maker or a deal breaker when a consumer is deciding where to shop, even though in both cases the cost is ultimately borne by the consumer. Most online mattress sellers offer free returns, in some cases for up to a year. Used mattresses can't be resold. So the loss, usually some 8% or 9% of sales, is folded into prices. Quote, you've got to tread carefully if you try to ratchet back ease of returns, so that you don't drive your consumer to your competitor, end quote, said Chung Johnson, who served as Walmart's senior director of returns between 2005 and 2012, and is now the chief strategy officer at GoTRG, a returns management company. As a consequence, even as sellers are subtly and not so subtly discouraging returns, they're also exploring easy ways to make them easier. Some Target stores now have drive-up refund windows. Many online returns no longer have to be repackaged. Just get a QR code on the seller's site and take the item to a location that consolidates shipments. Amazon offers Prime customers a 7-day, quote-unquote, try-before-you-buy option on selected apparel and accessories. You pay only for what you keep. Pollen Returns uses underemployed rideshare and delivery drivers to pick up unwanted items free at buyers' homes, thereby sparing them the nuisance of schlepping things on their own. Some retailers simply refund certain purchases, no need to send anything back. My wife ordered a funny poster for a high school reunion, then decided it wasn't funny enough. When she tried to return it, Amazon told her to keep it and refunded her $32.72. Perhaps surprisingly, companies that sell sofa beds, dining tables, and other bulky heavy items often do the same, because free return freight is so expensive. A new industry blooms. If you leave money lying around, someone will pick it up. Liquidity Services operates 8 regional warehouse-sized facilities in North America. The one in Pittston, Pennsylvania, is at the outer edge of a business park that also includes distribution or return facilities owned by Amazon, Home Depot, Lennox, Neiman Marcus, PepsiCo, and a number of smaller companies. The rise of online shopping has been very good for people who build immense, low, flat-roofed metal structures. Similar complexes now exist all over the United States in locations that have easy access to highways and airports. More are always under construction. You can register as a buyer on Liquidity Services website, as I did recently, and place bids in any of hundreds of auctions. I didn't do that, but I did spend a pleasant morning setting items that other people were bidding on, among them a 2-pallet log containing 654 pounds of sports-related Amazon returns. The lot included 7 pellet guns, 6 clear plastic umbrellas, 8 yoga mats, a minnow trap, an indoor exercise trampoline, a pair of hiking poles, 2 hoverboards, a quiver's worth of crossbow bolts, 114 items in all. Liquidity Services had estimated their combined original retail value at $6,576. The lot ended up attracting 50 bids. The winner paid $925, shipping not included. None of the bidders were willing to offer more than 15 cents on the dollar, and even at the price, they were taking a chance, since there was no guarantee that any particular item would still function. Return items are often damaged, dented, scratched, or inoperable, and even ones that don't look too bad can be missing parts or accessories. Liquidators must quickly sort and resell goods, usually in bulk. Some companies do more. One of those is America's Remanufacturing Co., or ARC, based in Georgia, which contracts with brand owners to receive their returns and, when possible, to repair or refurbish them so that they can be sold by others. ARC is also one of Amazon's external repair vendors. For every item, ARC knows the potential resale price, what percentage of that price the brand owner is willing to spend on refurbishment, and the cost of each potential intervention. Some problems are too expensive to address. Pressure washers with broken pumps are stripped of usable elements and thrown into a steel hopper to be sent later to a local recycling company. This spring, I met with Paul Adamson, the company's chief revenue officer at ARC's facility in Union Point, Georgia. The building is on a short and potholed road with an aspirational name, Industrial Boulevard. As we walked through the receiving area, a large open space that was filled with recent arrivals, tilting piles of household appliances, stacks of yellow bins containing miscellaneous Amazon returns. We stopped in front of a pallet on which half a dozen Husqvarna pressure washers, made under a license by Briggs & Stratton, had been stacked and bound with plastic wrap. Alright, I'm gonna have to cut that short, I'm sorry. I guess we have all our time up. Thank you so much for listening today, and have a great day. Thank you.